Welcome to the Next Brave Thing podcast. My name is Ella Hooper, and I believe that breakthrough is on the other side of bravery. This podcast features brave stories, emotional health, and creativity to inspire you to take your next brave step. Today on the podcast, I am doing a solo episode on guidepost number 3, which is Dr. Brené Brown's guides to living a wholehearted life. And the guidepost is cultivating a resilient spirit, letting go of numbing and powerlessness. Now, I don't think I've met someone who doesn't numb in one form or another, like doesn't check out, doesn't just scroll through their phone. I think that we're all kind of common, like that's a kind of common humanity link that a lot of us have cultivated a lot of numbing in our life. And I think it's because a lot of us aren't really taught that we all have a window of tolerance and we have a capacity for what, you know, how much stress we can handle, how much, we can have on our plate. And so today I'm going to be talking about how to cultivate a resilient spirit. What are the attributes of that someone who's resilient embody? I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about hope because, as you'll discover, is like in order to have resilience, we really need hope. And I'm going to talk about my journey of feeling powerless and and this is a term that researchers or psychologists in the 1960s came up with, which is learned helplessness, where you kind of lose trust in your ability to do something. And so I'm going to share some of, my journey with that. But then I really think there needs to be an emphasis on the nervous system. So I'm going to go through how, like explaining all the different fight, flight, fawn, freeze responses we have when we see a threat or perceived threat. And just kind of to give some language around that, because I think for the longest time, I would look at my procrastination, my numbing, my powerlessness, as a space of I need to change my mindset. Like I need, my belief systems are wrong. And I think that that's maybe a big portion of the equation in really building up our resilience. So mindset for sure. But I think a big thing, because I would look into my limiting beliefs, I would look into my inner child work, I would look into, is it because I believe I'm not worthy of that or don't believe I'm enough for that? And I'd kind of like go around these things, but it wasn't until the last couple of years where I actually learned a lot more about our window of tolerance as humans and who we are in stress. And so I'm going to talk through the different states that we go into when we have perceived threat. And so that has certainly helped me understand, and learning how to regulate has really helped me actually build up a tolerance for challenge and build up a tolerance for hard moments. And so I think that I'll start by kind of going through the list. And again, this is kind of initially like taken from Brené Brown's book, Gift of Imperfection. And resilience isn't just surviving hard things, it's transforming pain into purpose. So research shows that resilient people share these 5 things that I'm going to share and these kind of qualities. So the first one is like they have a strong sense of connection. So they cultivate authentic relationships and know they don't have to do life alone. So that's why we're made for community. We're made to do life together. And I think something that I'll go into when I talk about hope is like when we feel like we're alone, that's when we're going to have hopelessness around something. And so that strong sense of connection, learning actually how to be vulnerable. And that's why I did the podcast with John Toms talking about vulnerability, because I want us to kind of learn how to do connection, because a lot of us weren't really taught, and we come from families with broken attachment systems and we don't even really know how to create community. And so if we have that strong sense or learn how to cultivate it, And again, this is like learning how to be do connection and community isn't a fixed trait of whether you can do it or you can't do it. It's something that you can learn. So there's hope even inside of that. The second is for resilient people, the thing that they have in common is they have some emotional awareness. So they recognize, name, and process emotions instead of avoiding or numbing them. And I really love Brené Brown's Atlas of the Heart book because it gives you language for the emotions that you're feeling. And sometimes, and this is like so common, and even I've probably mislabeled different definitions of, you know, what emotions are even on this podcast, but often we're misdiagnosing our situation or mislabeling what's happening. And so there is even research that shows that if we say that we're experiencing an emotion, like let's say we just say, oh, we're in despair about this thing and we're kind of being dramatic or whatever, like words are really powerful. Like if, and it's one thing to actually say, oh, I'm in despair, and you genuinely are, and like using that language may actually create relief because it validates like what you're feeling. But if you're using language to misdiagnose like what's actually happening, you can actually take yourself into that worse state. So emotions can kind of change as you speak them out. So it's really important to kind of get attunement and really get clarity. And what attunement is like you are learning to speak accurately about what's happening inside you. And so when you can do that, you can actually share it with other people, which forms a greater bond of connection. And when we have that bond, it strengthens us and gives us resilience. So then the third thing that resilient people have is clear values and purpose. They live in alignment with their lives. A strong why gives them meaning even in difficulty. And I remember, and I talk a lot in coaching with people around their jobs and misaligned careers, which I'm going to have more on misaligned careers in a later podcast, but I think sometimes we're exhausted and feeling defeated because we're in a job that we hate because it pays the bills. And then there can be this feeling of hopelessness that can come up because we have to be in the job because we have to pay bills, but really we would love to pursue a different kind of career. And that's such a tension to kind of work out because you don't want to be foolish and just not have a job. But I think getting really clear about your values and your purpose and actually getting clarity around what matters to you, then when you start making, you know, adjustments in your life to live that aligned life, you will actually start feeling more like yourself, which means you'll be in authenticity and in flow. And so then you'll feel a sense of resilience. And I mean, I do kind of think, because sometimes like there can be this illusion that we fully are crystal clear about our purpose and what our job should be, and we should be living in our dream job. And I think it's really important to meet with a coach or a counselor to kind of reframe like where you're at and break down where you're at and how to get into an alignment or an aligned career or aligned purpose that really meets those needs. Like there's a way of reframing like where you're at in that. And then there's, so number four is boundaries and self-compassion. So resilient people will have boundaries and self-compassion. They protect their energy and offer themselves grace when they fall short. And when I think of an abundance mindset, I think about energy. When I think of a lack of resilience, I think of a lack of energy and motivation to do things. And so I think like a huge thing in my life, like I haven't actually worked with a narcissist, I don't think, ever in my life, but I definitely have worked in work cultures where the energy in the environment felt narcissistic, as in it really took from me. And so it actually was so exhausting, the work, that it made me feel less resilient and not have a tolerance for, like I'd have a short fuse about things because I just felt like this place is like taking all of my energy. And so I had to really learn boundaries and then self-compassion for, yeah, like moments where I would fall short. And I think self-compassion is such a huge ingredient to cultivating resilience. And because it actually like you like let go of the war that's happening inside you. You actually connect to yourself. You have compassion on yourself. You're on your own team. That's one of my favorite kind of self-compassion statements is like, Ella, I'm on your team. And so that's one thing that, you know, is really powerful in building up resilience. And then number five is hope and belief in growth. And so resilient people believe in their ability to grow through adversity and hold on to hope. And I think that like hope is, I used to think it was an emotion. And then Rick Snyder, who's I think a psychologist, he says that hope is actually more a belief system than an emotion, whereas hopelessness is an emotion. And I love in Atlas of the Heart, Brené Brown says, hope is a function of struggle. We develop hope not during the easy or comfortable times, but through adversity and discomfort. So if you're going through something challenging, you are going to be really sharpening your belief system around hope. Rick Snyder says, hope is the belief that your future can be better than your past and you have the power to make it so. I've also heard that hopelessness is the feeling that you will wake up the next day and it will still be the same. I think it's Rob Bell who says that, is like that kind of despair of like, oh, Groundhog Day. Is this just another day where it's kind of the same? So Snyder, who's the pioneer in hope theory, defined hope as a combination of both willpower and way power. So willpower is the drive to keep going and your belief in your ability to do it. And then the way power is the ability to find a path forward. And I think that there are some personalities out there that have really strong willpower. It's actually in their makeup, in their, just in their DNA and their personality, they actually have strong willpower. The beautiful thing is it's not either you have it or you don't have it. It's something that you can actually cultivate. And I think that sometimes, I know, especially in my early 20s, I would have a goal and I would be all inspired and then I'd do it for 3 days and then I'd give up. And I think that when we have so much repetition around that, we can really hit the defeat button really quickly. And I know for me, like I remember being so depressed in my 20s, feeling like that I just feel like I have a what's the point monster in my soul. That's like, what's the point of even trying? Because I just feel defeated. And, you know, like what's the point of, yeah, going after dreams, because I'll always have a setback and always have a trigger. And that's why I love, even when I do group coaching or have taught in the past, is like, that's awesome. We can get crystal clear on your vision and your goals and we can go through all that. But I actually want to know who you are in stress. I want to know what your limiting beliefs are, because that's probably going to be the thing that's going to get in the way of you accomplishing these lovely goals and dreams and visions that you have. And I think the people that have cultivated like discipline in their life, some of it is because they had really disciplined childhoods. And I remember kind of really noticing this when I was a lecturer at a university, and you would see the students who really knew how to meet deadlines, do all the correct formatting in their papers, like do everything really well, know how to read the room in the classroom and engage in conversation. And then there would be the ones that would show up late, deadlines are late, like they miss deadlines, they forget that they, you know, ate my homework, those sort of things. And I actually had a lot of compassion for those people, because I, especially like some of our students, like didn't have parents that were present with them growing up. So they never had someone saying, hey, you're not watching that show now. You're actually doing your homework. And we actually like need that growing up. So this is where you can have compassion for yourself, because if you're trying to set goals like you would your friend who had an idyllic childhood where they had structure and routine and safety and consistency in their home, and you grew up in a home where there was so much chaos and inconsistency and ambivalence, maybe your parents were alcoholics and like you didn't know what was going to happen that day, and then you're trying to compare yourself to the really like the stable person, like, and then you're trying to have goals that are the same as that person. Like, that's where we want self-compassion, because like no one taught you how to do that. And so that's the power of reparenting. And even in certain parts of my childhood, I actually had like a lot of structure and a lot of like, I had a lot of really good parenting, like as far as boundaries and like you need to do this at this time. And so I have an element of that that's natural in my life. But there's certain areas where I have actually had to learn to parent myself to kind of create discipline and structure, even as an adult. And so I think that part of what hope is that willpower, that belief that if I set a goal, I'll achieve it. It's that kind of like self-trust and expectation that you have on yourself. And even through learning the nervous system, like if you're in freeze a lot of the time, you could be shaming yourself because you're not being productive, but your whole body is locked up in like one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake. And so you're like trying to move, but you just fully feel stuck. And I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, I've tried to reparent. I've tried to like change my mindset about, you know, having compassionate goals rather than these lofty big goals of habits that I want to achieve. And I would still kind of fall short until I really learned the nervous system. And so the thing is with hope, like if we don't have hope, and this is where a lot of people lead to suicide, which is like they have the emotion of despair. And so if you're in a place of despair, I just have so much compassion because I've had seasons and pockets of my life in that feeling, and it's so displacing and it's so powerless. Like it's an awful feeling. And I also think sometimes like, you know, I think understanding trauma is so helpful to have a compassionate lens on that, because I think there can be a lot of shame around feeling despair and actually like, because sometimes we are a victim. And I know that there's a lot of, you know, that's victim behavior. You don't want to be a victim. And I actually am really into that too. But then I also know how debilitating trauma is and how you literally can't function the way a normal person would, and you kind of feel crazy, and some of you don't even know that you've gone through, aren't even aware that you've gone through trauma. You just feel so like, why can't I do normal things that everybody else can do? And so I just hope that that gives some grace and compassion to you, because I think really understanding your season, where you're at, and for some of you, you are just learning, if you've been in that season of despair, highly recommend you talk to a psychologist. You're learning to actually cultivate like baby steps towards hope. And I think that we cultivate hope through the power of testimony. It's when we see to believe, like when we hear someone's story and we see to believe it could be possible to us, like that starts to build hope. And I notice like some testimonies aren't helpful. So it's like, well, that's easy for them because they had a perfect childhood. They had all this support given to them, and of course they can accomplish their dreams. Like, you know, it's actually really powerful when you can find testimonies, and there's so many out there now because we have YouTube and podcasts and so much language. Like when you start kind of, if you have like a bank account, a hope bank account, you start making deposits of hope through listening to testimonies and meditating on those moments, like that can start to kind of shift your spirit, like, and cause your spirit to rise up over your soul and cultivate, hope. But it's kind of sometimes I think, oh, that's good for you. Like that testimony is great, but also you had all these things in place. And so it is helpful to find testimonies that you can identify with of like, that is my story. I felt like that. And that's giving me language. And so when we have a loss of hope, we actually lose mobility. So the ability to like move forward. And so that's why we're learning as we cultivate more resilience is like, how do we find motion? And I know some personalities, and I've even had seasons where my nervous system was just so shot where I'd be like, oh, it takes a lot of inertia to make something happen. Like I need inertia to get me moving. And so I think that like ways to cultivating hope is, recognizing that like finding language for your season of life kind of gives you hope because you're like, this is all I can focus on right now. That's not fully realistic because I think that hope really needs to come with a strategy. And I love Jeremiah 29:11, which is a famous verse, which is, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." And so I love that hope in this context comes with a plan. So I think there's also like letting go of like, because sometimes people think like, oh, I'm not even doing God's plan for my life, I'm failing. But it's actually like God's way more compassionate and he's very trauma informed. So he actually gets like where you're at and what you need. And he has a plan for where you are at right now. And so even that hope of like something bigger than me has a plan for my situation, because hopelessness can definitely come from feeling alone in what you're going through. And so I'm going to shift into talking about like the fight, flight, freeze, and fawn responses. And as you guys know, I did the course Reclaiming You, and I'm going to have, different experts in to talk about the nervous system. So I'm not an expert, even though I have done a lot of work around it and hopefully have some language that can be helpful. But I'm going to get some experts on to really speak into it, and have had many people speak on this in my podcast, but I think that like when I think of resilience, I'm not just talking about like the freeze state, which is really where we, like I mentioned, one foot on the gas and one on the brake. Like you've got all this energy kind of circling around you, and then you kind of numb and check out. And as I've mentioned before, that story follows state. So if you're in a state of freeze, the story that might happen is a lot of hopeless thoughts like, this will never change. I just want to isolate. I don't want to be around people. And so when I think of sometimes like building up a tolerance for the challenge is, and I'm going to get Rachel Hughes on the podcast to talk about glimmers and safety and learning how to hold that challenge, like have one foot in challenge and one foot in safety. But really learning about freeze, and this has been the big one because I go into freeze a lot. I mean, far less than what I used to, but freeze is, the main thing that you need to get out of freeze is to thaw. And so like pushing through is not necessarily going to help your freeze state. So ultimately you're trying to get your nervous system into feeling safe again. And so I would get into freeze state and I would go into deep introspection about why am I freezing? What's triggered me? Like I would try and do that. And I would kind of go into flight then, which is kind of OCD looping about introspecting about what's going on with me. And but I also kind of wanted to talk about, because I think that's connected to building up resilience in getting stuff done, productivity, going after dreams, pursuing community, that sort of thing. But I think there's also something to be said for the person who goes into fight, and everybody probably does. Some personalities, like their tendency can be to go into fight automatically, like predominantly. I think mine is probably flight and freeze, and fawn can come into all of those ones, but which is people pleasing. But fight, like I used to kind of have some morality against like which is the better one to go into in stress. And now I just have compassion for anyone that is in a stressed response who's interpreting threat. But those of you who go into fight a lot, and I work with clients that like any sort of moment, they'll just kind of fire off and like get really like aggressive, or they start lawyering and being like, you know, this is wrong about what happened, and you know, that kind of thing. And I think there's something to be said of even building up a resilience to have a little separation from our big reactions, like jumping into fight. So I'm going to go through each of the responses real quick and explain the different ones. And this is where I have so much compassion, because a lot of us are trying to change people's behavior around us. And then you start focusing on yourself when you go into healing, because you cannot change someone around you. And that's another place of learned helplessness and powerlessness, when we have someone we deeply, deeply love in our life and we really want to change them because like we have compassion, we want to see them do better. But no one wants to feel like a project. No one wants to be fixed. And so the most powerful thing that you can do is actually turn inward to you and just focus on you becoming the most radiant whole person, because that's magnetic. That is the thing that makes people feel capable of changing, because they see, wow, you really changed that thing about you. Like, tell me more of how you did it. And then you invite people because they're inspired by you versus feeling controlled by you. And so sometimes like when we've tried to communicate and we've tried to do all these tools and tried to make people around us change, like that can actually create such a defeat button in us. And so I encourage those of you who are in that position, and I feel like I ebb and flow in and out of it, like depending on what relationships and what codependency looks like in my life. And so I just encourage you to like come back and turn towards your own experience rather than fixing the other people's experience and what's happening in other people, to just really come back to yourself and really learn how to get regulated, transform your side of the fence, because ultimately that's going to be the most inspiring thing for change. And it's humble, like it keeps you humble for sure. So the fight response is like when the energy in our body turns outward to protect us. You may feel an urge to act fast, argue, control, confront. And so basically your body is mobilized for battle. And then you're kind of quick to argue, defend, or interrupt. You have sharp words. You over-explain things. You have anger, frustration, rage, a lot of looping thoughts, replaying arguments, or future, like you're replaying future confrontations, very much all or nothing thinking. And all of these four Fs have black and white thinking. So, and I think a big one with fight is sometimes like you actually get really calm. This is where it feels disguised, because, and I know this, like it's not a wonderful quality, but you can get really quiet and then you kind of start lawyering someone. And it's really, you have a need to fix, punish, win, and control. So yeah, that's a real thing. And so there's definitely a deep inner critic when you're in fight. A lot of harsh self-talk and self-blame, a lot of criticizing of other people. You feel emotionally explosive or shut down. And so some of your fear, like physical cues, could be tense jaw, clenched fists, shaking, sweating, heat in your chest, edgy tone, loud voice, urge to move forcefully, punch, scream, stomp. Yeah, so it's pretty intense when we get into fight. And I notice, like, sometimes, like, for me, I think I go more into fight with people that I know really well. It'll just, like, kind of come out of me. It'll be like a jabby thing that will come out and kind of try and shut someone down or, like, correct someone real quick. It's just not the greatest thing. That's what I do sometimes, guys. Not a perfect human. Anyway, so flight, which I just find so relatable, is really when our energy moves outward to escape. You feel the urge to get away physically, mentally, or emotionally. So busyness, and then, avoidance of any perceived discomfort or danger. And when I was doing the Reclaiming You course, they talked a lot about, like, when you get on a Zoom call, like, because they would run courses, they're like, you're probably going to have a lot of flight energy because, you know, the content that they're talking about, they're going to have, like, it's going to be maybe an emotional time, like, emotions might come up. And so because of the uncertainty of that, you could find yourself, like, not wanting to sit and be present and listen to the Zoom talk. You might want to bounce around and look at Pinterest and find a recipe for dinner tonight and or clean your house while you listen to it, because you can't really be present. And you're constantly planning, fixing, fantasizing, or jumping to the next thing. You're feeling rushed, chased, or unable to slow down. You want to leave the room, the conversation, and the situation. So, yeah, that's another one that we can do. Yeah, so flight is like a real disconnection from being present, and you can have a lot of fast talking and monologuing. And I think, like, something that I've learned with trauma is that it's a trauma response, like when you constantly need to verbally process. And there's a difference, like there are definitely genuine verbal processes and internal processes. Sounded very American at that point. Processing, sorry. Anyway, so with flight, and especially if you've gone through trauma, it's very much a trauma response to over-explain everything and feel like you need to give every single detail of the situation. And that's probably because there's been deep pain in the past where you haven't felt heard and you haven't felt seen. And so sometimes we find ourselves just monologuing at someone versus actually being tuned in to, like, what's happening, are we present, and letting go of the need to over-explain ourselves. So that's very much a flight response. And so other things that we do is, and I think, like, that is, like, when we're monologuing to someone, we're really disconnected from ourselves because we're not really present with what's happening inside us. We're more concerned with, like, the busyness in our mind of, like, I better make sure, like, they know every single detail of so that I'm not misunderstood, because the threat is being misunderstood, if that makes sense. So with flight, you're going to be zoning out or feeling emotionally attached. You're hyper aware of possible threats. You're OCD looping and fixing, and feeling the urge to fix something immediately. And so it's, like, really interesting because, you know, I've had a few things, like, happen with family members or different things happening. And so it's really quick to go, like, go into advice of, like, here's all the million things that you could be doing to fix your situation. And really that's, like, a flight response because the threat is I'm not okay when other people aren't okay. And so the physical cues could be racing thoughts, you can't sit still, shallow breathing, eye darting, restless legs, and like you're on a treadmill going too fast. So those are some of the cues. And then going into freeze, which is when our energy shuts down, you feel numb, disconnected, or stuck. The response seeks safety through immobilization and withdrawal. And that's a big one. I just want to Netflix and chill and withdraw from the universe. So shutting down emotions to get through the moment. feeling numb, foggy, or blank, struggling to think, feel, or act, wanting to hide, hibernate, or be invisible, ignoring messages, tasks, or responsibility. And so there's that avoidance factor with freeze as well. And some of the thought patterns are really like everything's too much or it's pointless, all or nothing thinking, catastrophizing, I don't know what I feel, or I just want to disappear. So you feel pretty heavy in your body, blank staring, feeling distant, frozen, tired. Tiredness, wanting to sleep is definitely a big one. You have really stuck energy, so you don't know how to move energy through your body. So that's definitely a feeling I am aware of. And so with fawn is actually not necessarily a stress response. It's actually because it can actually be in, like, you could be in a fight response but go into fawn. So it's when your energy turns outward to appease, you focus on others' emotions to avoid conflict or rejection, losing touch with your own needs and boundaries and your voice. And so your real goal in form is really to keep the peace at all costs, saying yes when you want to say no, you're over-apologizing or over-explaining or over-helping, and you're becoming overly agreeable or making jokes to ease tension. You're really fixating on other people's reactions and their moods, and you struggle to have your own voice and own opinion and make your own decisions. So it's that kind of that thing of like, where do you want to go for dinner? I don't know. Where do you want to go for dinner? Like that thing. If you're not okay, I'm not okay is a thought pattern that someone in form will have. It's my job to fix this. You have the fear of being too much or not enough or disliked. And the black and white thinking for someone in fawn is you either love me or you hate me. And some of the physical cues, you might have nervous laughter or fake smiling, leaning forward or scanning for emotional danger, feeling hollow, anxious, or disconnected from your body. And yeah, so some of these, there's so much nuance to all of these fight, flight, fawn, freeze responses. So even me just kind of running through them just now, like there's probably a lot more nuance to what I was sharing. But hopefully that kind of paints a picture of you actually like building up awareness of how you respond in different situations, like when you are stressed. And even like something that I'm practicing right now is like, what's threatening to me? What feels threatening? Is it like certain people, finances? Is it something to do with social media or interact? Like what is actually threatening? So it's helpful to even get awareness of like what are you interpreting as a threat? And so part of me learning how to come out of these responses is really learning to have some self-forgiveness and self-compassion on the way that I've responded in the past. And this is where I love the quote that says, forgive who you were in survival mode, because all of us are wired to survive. So this is kind of how we can show up when we are just trying to survive our lives. And so have compassion on yourself. But I think that like building up a tolerance and building up resilience only comes, I think this is where we can get so defeated, because we have this belief that we're going to have this radical thing happen where our life completely changes, but we're still stuck in our bodies, and our bodies are like patterned into, like our nervous system and our stress responses are patterned in. So you could have something really amazing and awesome happen, but you may not be able to fully enjoy it because your nervous system is so dysregulated. And so part of like building up resilience, and this is what I learned in the Reclaiming You course, is really learning how to feel 1 to 5% better. Rather than, and because I think the defeat and the hopelessness happens when we feel like we fail our goal, but it feels actually more achievable if I can look at like my goals and how to cultivate hope is like, I'm going to actually learn how to feel 1% more regulated today, or 1 to 5% more at peace. And the more we do that, the more it's almost like it compounds, and then we start feeling more and more safe in our nervous system, safe in our bodies and in our experiences, which then in turn makes all of our perception of our life and our reality change. And again, hope is a belief system. So your hope will then increase because you're learning to connect to your body and learning how to shift your responses very gently. A lot of people can feel really discouraged when they're first learning their nervous system responses because they feel a lot of shame of, I went into fight again, or I went into fawn again. But just know that you've probably had 20, 30, 40, 50 plus years of responding this one way, and it's all learned behavior. And the good news is, because you learned it, you can unlearn it and learn a new way of responding. So I think where we can get in the hopelessness track is when we expect that all of a sudden, because I listened to a podcast about the nervous system, I'm going to quickly be able to change my stress responses straight away. And that's really not the case. So it's really important that as you learn to build up resilience and learn to build up hope, is that you go gently and you go slowly. In that direction, and learn to, like, I used to go to the beach but not really notice like how beautiful it felt to walk on the sand, like feeling those grains of sand in my feet, or be in the ocean and not feel like the beauty of, I was so disconnected that I just would not be able to take in those beautiful moments. And I think when I've really talked with people who have gone through incredible grief or loss and suffering, they say that the way to healing is actually starting to tune into those little moments. And so wherever you're at right now in your life, the way that you can build up your resilience and build up your capacity is through the teeny tiny little moments. And then they start to accumulate, and then you start to feel that increase of possibility and hope. And then finding some regulating exercises that work for you. And I'm working on a podcast episode where I go into practically everything that I do to regulate, learning about breath work and learning about meditation and those sort of things. And so part of those things are going to help strengthen your nervous system and give yourself a new pattern in your body. And so if you are really struggling with hopelessness, I definitely recommend a therapist. Would go, you know, speaking to a psychologist about that. But if you're really wanting to cultivate hope and reframe your experience, because I think some of it is like actually having re-envisioning where you're at in life, I'd love to chat to you. You can always book in a coaching session. But thanks for listening today, guys. I love hearing your comments and when you share the episode on social media. So feel free to go share that on Instagram or Facebook and write a review. But thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening today. Please download, share with your friends, and write a review. If you would like to book in a life coaching session with me, go to my website at www.ella-hooper.com or follow me on Instagram at Next Brave Thing Podcast.